So before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 99 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams.
Which are weighted just like the real thing, which is huge.
Yeah, exactly. So check it out at certfuel.com.
Definitely.
Okay, so I want you to picture it. It's the late 1920s.
Oh boy.
You're, I don't know, a shoeshine boy or a taxi driver, a school teacher, whatever.
Right.
And you just keep hearing about this magical wealth machine called the stock market.
It's just printing money.
Right. And you want in, but you only have $100.
Yeah.
So you go to a broker and they're like, "Hey, let me tell you about this wonderful new concept called buying on margin."
The magic word.
Yeah, you hand them your $100, they lend you like 900 more, and suddenly you are holding $1,000 worth of RCA stock.
Sounds great, right?
It sounds amazing.
Yeah.
The stock goes up 10%, and boom, you just doubled your actual cash investment.
Free money.
Right? It feels like free money. Until October 1929 rolls around.
Yeah, the reality check.
Exactly. The market drops 10%. Your $100 of equity is just instantly wiped out.
Gone.
And the market just keeps dropping. So now you owe the broker money you don't have.
And the broker owes the bank money they don't have.
Right. And the entire financial system just goes up in smoke. And it's all because of this one underlying concept, credit risk.
Yes.
The moment you introduce credit, like the moment you start buying things with money you don't actually possess,
They're a liability.
you are a walking, talking systemic liability.
Yeah. And that historical context, it's so vital because it explains literally everything we're looking at today.
Right.
Like managing that specific liability is an absolute obsession for regulators.
They don't want another 1929.
Exactly. The rules we're going to explore today, they didn't just, come out of thin air. They were written in the ashes of market crashes.
Oh, wow. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. I mean, the operational professionals at a broker dealer, they're essentially the financial fire department.
Okay. I like that.
Right. Their entire job is to basically hold the hoses and make sure a single spark from, a leveraged trader doesn't burn down the whole firm.
Which in turn protects the broader market.
Exactly.
Okay, so we are putting on our fireproof suits today. If you are prepping for the Series 99 exam, managing this credit risk is function one.
It's massive.
It is. We're tackling margin and securities lending, and this represents 35 scored items,
Which is what, like 70%?
a whopping 70% of the exam.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So we really need to lock this information into your brain so you can, recall it under pressure.
Definitely.
And because this material is, let's be honest, pretty dense,
It can be very dry.
very dry. So we're going to use some highly specific characters to keep things grounded in reality.
Using recurring hypotheticals is honestly the best way to understand the mechanical plumbing of all these rules.
It makes it a story, not a textbook. Exactly. Okay, so allow me to introduce our cast. First, we have Margin Mary.
Okay, I know a few Marys.
We all do. She is an overly ambitious, hyper-caffeinated day trader who views leverage not as a tool, but like as a lifestyle.
Oh boy, she loves the danger.
She loves it. She pushes her account limits to the absolute brink every day.
Naturally.
Next, we have Deficit Dan.
Deficit Dan.
Now, Dan means well, but he has the worst market timing in human history.
Terrible lot.
Terrible. He is the guy constantly withdrawing cash from his trading account to buy something ridiculous like a jet ski.
At the worst possible moment.
At the exact moment his portfolio is crashing.
Yes.
Yes.
Classic Dan.
And finally, we have Lending Larry.
Okay, who's Larry?
Larry is a massive institutional player, so picture a giant faceless pension fund.
Gotcha.
Larry holds millions of shares and essentially acts like a massive rental car agency, but for stock certificates.
Right, okay. So those three really represent the core actors in any margin ecosystem.
Yeah, you've got the aggressive borrower, the liquidity drain, and the source of assets.
Exactly. The ultimate source of borrowed assets. And honestly, if we just look at how the firm controls Margin Mary, we pretty much understand the entire regulatory framework.
Okay, well, let's start there. Let's figure out how Mary even gets into the casino in the first place.
Right.
Because before she can start borrowing money to fuel her trading, we need to know if she's even legally allowed to do it.
We have to look at the foundation, the accounts and agreements.
Right. Because if Mary just opens a standard cash account, the dynamic is incredibly simple.
Oh yeah, very simple. She buys $10,000 of stock, she has to deposit $10,000 in cash.
Period.
Period. There's no credit extension. The loop is just closed.
But if she wants a margin account...
Then the broker-dealer is agreeing to act as a lender. They're saying, sure, we'll fund a portion of your eligible securities transactions.
Okay, listener, listen up right now. This is an exam trap. I'm calling it out explicitly. This is where the exam tries to get you.
It's a huge trap.
Imagine Mary transfers in, let's say, $50,000 worth of fully paid Apple stock into her brand new brokerage account.
Okay.
Yeah.
Apple is highly liquid, so it's fantastic collateral.
Right. The trap is assuming that because she has marginal collateral just sitting in her account, she automatically has margin privileges.
Oh, yeah. They love to test that. The presence of marginal securities does not, in any way, authorize the extension of credit.
Okay. The way I think about it, it's like having a car title but no driver's license.
Oh, I like that.
Right. Like, the car has value. You own the car outright. You could sell it.
Sure.
But simply holding the title does not give you the legal authority to take it out and drive it on the highway.
You still need the DMV to approve you.
Exactly.
That analogy tracks perfectly, actually, because to actually trade on margin, the regulatory framework requires two distinct pieces of documentation to be in place.
Two things.
First, you need formal firm approval of the account.
Okay, what does that actually mean, though?
Well, a designated principal at the broker-dealer has to actually review Mary's financial situation, her investment experience, her risk tolerance.
So you have to make sure she's not going to ruin her life.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
And then they officially stamp the account as approved from margin.
Okay, so the firm says yes, but that is only one half of the puzzle.
Right. The firm's approval alone still doesn't authorize the credit.
So what's the second piece?
The second and equally critical piece is the customer's signed margin agreement.
Ah.
Yeah, this is the legally binding contract where Mary basically acknowledges the terms of the loan, the interest rates, and the firm's rights to just liquidate her assets if things go south.
They need the signature.
Yeah, the broker-dealer has to prove they established the rules of engagement before lending a single dollar.
Okay, so let's repeat that for the folks taking notes. Approved account plus signed agreement.
Yes, both are required.
Marginal collateral alone does nothing.
Nothing at all.
Okay, so Mary gets approved. She signs the paperwork. She is officially ready to borrow. How much money does she actually need to put down to start trading?
Well, to answer that,
yeah,
we actually have to split Mary's trading activity into two completely separate timelines.
Okay, timelines.
Yeah, because the requirements at the moment she initiates a trade are governed by a totally different set of rules than the requirements for holding that trade over the long term.
Okay, so side-by-side comparison here. Timeline one is initial margin.
Right.
I view this as the down payment. You want to buy a house, you put down a percentage up front.
Yeah.
You want to buy stock on margin, you put down initial margin.
Exactly.
But I'm looking at my notes here, and it says this is governed by Regulation T, which is set by the Federal Reserve.
Yep.
Why on earth is the central banking system of the United States regulating Margin Mary's day trading account?
Well, it goes back to the historical context we talked about earlier.
Oh, 1929.
Right. After 1929, the government realized that unchecked leverage in the stock market could quite literally destroy the entire banking system.
Wow.
So the Federal Reserve was given the authority under Regulation T to control the flow of credit into the securities markets. It's essentially a macroeconomic tool.
Oh, so they can tighten or loosen the margin requirements to sort of cool down or stimulate speculation.
Precisely. And currently, Regulation T requires 50% initial margin for long equity purchases.
Okay, so simple math. If Mary wants to buy $10,000 of stock, the Fed mandates that she pulls at least $5,000 out of her own pocket.
Yep, and the broker can lend her the other five.
Okay, that establishes the position.
But once the trade is actually executed, we move into the second timeline.
Timeline two.
Yeah, maintenance margin. Because the Federal Reserve sets that initial hurdle, but they're not micromanaging the daily, you know, fluctuations of Mary's account.
Right. Jerome Powell is not watching Mary's tech stocks.
No, he is not. That responsibility falls to FINRA.
Ah, FINRA, the self-regulatory organization.
Right. Because FINRA's job isn't macroeconomics.
FINRA's job is making sure the specific broker-dealer doesn't go bankrupt because Mary's stock tanked.
Exactly. So FINRA mandates an equity floor that Mary has to maintain as long as the position remains open.
An equity floor.
Yeah. And for a standard long marginable equity security, FINRA sets that floor at 25% of the current market value.
Okay, listener, pause and think about this for a second. If Mary is staring at her trading screen, right, She's about to click buy to open a brand new position. Does she look at FINRA's rules or Reg T first?
Give them a beat to think.
Okay, what's the answer?
When opening a position, the rule is always to take the greatest applicable amount.
The greatest amount.
Right. She has to satisfy the federal Reg T amount, the FINRA maintenance amount, or honestly, a higher house requirement if her specific firm is just more conservative.
Oh, so the firm can ask for more.
Yeah. And there is also a baseline $2,000 equity floor required by FINRA just to establish a margin account.
Wait, let's unpack that $2,000 floor, because I have definitely seen practice questions where this gets super tricky.
Oh, the exam loves the exception here.
Right, because the general rule is you need $2,000 in equity to play the game. But what if Mary only wants to buy a very small amount of stock? What if she just wants to buy $1,500 of some random tech stock?
That is the classic exception. The $2,000 minimum equity floor does not require a customer to deposit cash above the full cost of the security being purchased.
Oh, okay. So she doesn't have to deposit $2,000 to buy $1,500 of stock. She just pays the $1,500 in full.
Exactly. It basically acts like a cash trade within the margin account.
That makes total sense. Regulators aren't going to force you to over-deposit just to hit some arbitrary threshold if the asset you're buying doesn't even cost that much.
Right. They're just protecting the downside risk. And if it's fully paid, there is no credit risk.
Okay, cool. But let's flip the script, because the math is about to get incredibly weird. Marge and Mary doesn't want to buy a stock today. She looks at a company, she thinks it's fundamentally doomed, and she wants to short it.
Yeah, she's betting against it.
Yeah. I'm looking at the study material, and it says for a short, non-exempted equity security, the total Regulation T margin is 150%. Wait, first of all, pause. What does non-exempted mean here? What is it not exempt from?
Right. So a non-exempt security is simply a standard security that has to be registered with the SEC, like typical corporate stock.
Oh, okay.
It is not exempt from the standard regulatory rules. Exempt securities would be things like, you know, U.S. Treasuries, or municipal bonds, which have entirely different, usually way lower margin requirements.
Okay, got it. So she's shorting normal corporate stock. But how can the requirement be 150%? That sounds totally insane.
It does.
How can you be required to have more than the entire value of the asset just to make the trade?
So it seems totally counterintuitive until you look at the physical mechanics of a short sale. When Mary shorts a stock, she is borrowing shares she doesn't own and selling them to someone else in the open market.
And when she sells those borrowed shares, the buyer hands her actual cash.
Yes. And the cash generated from that sale, the proceeds, are deposited directly into Mary's account.
Oh.
Those proceeds cover the first 100%. The money is literally sitting right there.
Oh, I see where this is going.
But Regulation T says that having the proceeds isn't enough of a cushion.
Right.
Because if the stock price skyrockets, buying those shares back to return them is going to cost more than the proceeds she initially received.
Oh, man. Yeah.
So Reg T mandates that Mary deposit an additional 50% out of her own pocket.
Ah, okay. The math just clicked. The 150% total margin is just the 100% cash from the sale proceeds sitting in the account.
Yep.
Plus her 50% down payment deposit.
Exactly. And the exam loves to test this exact distinction. They will try to confuse you between the total margin in the account versus what the customer actually has to deposit.
Okay, listener, exam trap alert. If the question asks for the total Reg T margin on a short sale, you look for 150%.
Right.
But if the question asks for the customer's required deposit, it is only 50%. You have to read every single word of the prompt.
You really do. And remember, that 50% deposit only gets Mary in the door.
Right. We still have to deal with the maintenance floor for short positions.
Yeah. And FINRA is terrified of short sales.
Because theoretically, a stock's price can rise to infinity.
Exactly. Meaning Mary's potential losses are unlimited.
Wow.
Because of that risk, FINRA has very specific price-based tests for maintaining a short position.
Okay, let's break those down side by side. It all depends on whether the stock is trading above or below $5 a share, right?
Correct. For a stock priced at $5 per share or more, the maintenance requirement is the greater of $5 per share, or 30% of the current market value.
Okay, so 30% is higher than the 25% we saw for long positions. They're building in a bigger cushion.
Yeah.
But what if she's shorting an absolute garbage penny stock, something priced below $5?
Well, penny stocks are highly volatile. I mean, a $2 stock can jump to $4 in an hour.
Which is a 100% loss for a short seller.
Exactly. So the rule is much harsher. If the stock is below $5, the maintenance requirement is the greater of $2.50 per share, or 100% of the current market value.
Okay, listener, I'm going to ask you a direct question. Let's do the math together. If Margin Mary decides to short a penny stock at $3 a share, what is her maintenance requirement?
Give it a second.
Okay, let's run the formula. It's below $5, so we use the second rule. We need the greater of 250 or 100% of the market value.
Right.
100% of $3 is $3.
Yep.
Three is bigger than 250. So her maintenance requirement per share is $3. She has to hold the entire value of the stock in reserve just to keep the trade open.
Exactly. You have to run the greater of test manually every single time on the exam.
Yeah.
Do not just blindly apply a percentage.
That is such a good tip. Okay, so we've established the rules. Let's introduce some chaos.
Okay.
Let's say Margin Mary bought a bunch of tech stock on margin. The initial trade was fine, but overnight, the market completely tanks.
Oh, no.
The floor falls out. Her equity plummets way below that 25% maintenance level. We are entering the danger zone. What power does the broker-dealer actually have over her in this moment?
Well, this is where the margin agreement she signed at the very beginning comes back to haunt her. Specifically, a document called the Margin Disclosure Statement.
I was actually reading through the required disclosures in this document, and it is genuinely horrifying.
It's intense.
It reads less like a financial agreement and more like a total surrender of your civil rights.
Pretty much.
Let's walk through the six margin risks that the firm must disclose, because I am still shocked this is legal. So, risk number one.
Yeah.
It says you can lose more funds than you deposit.
Which makes sense, right? Hmm. You put down $5,000, borrow $5,000, and the $10,000 stock goes to zero.
You lost your five and you still owe the firm five.
Exactly.
Sure. But then risk two says the firm can force the sale of securities or other assets in any of your accounts. Wait, so they can raid my IRA if my margin account blows up?
Yes. Cross-collateralization can be incredibly broad depending on the specific account structures. If you owe them money, they will find a way to make themselves whole.
That is wild. And risk number three, the firm can sell your securities without contacting you. Wait, they don't even have to call me to tell me I'm losing my shirt.
No. In a fast-moving market crash, the firm does not have time to wait for Mary to, you know, answer her phone.
Right.
If her equity drops below the critical threshold, their computers will literally automatically start liquidating her positions to protect the firm's capital.
And risk number four says, the firm, not the customer, chooses what to sell. So if I have Apple stock that I love and some junk penny stock that I hate, they can just sell my Apple stock to cover the call.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
They will sell whatever is most liquid and easiest to clear. They honestly do not care about your tax strategy or your long-term investment goals.
That is brutal. Risk five. The firm can increase its house maintenance margin requirements at any time and is not required to provide you advance written notice, so they can just change the rules of the game while I'm playing it.
Yeah. If the volatility of a specific stock suddenly spikes, say, you know, a meme stock situation.
Oh, yeah, we've seen that.
The broker-dealer can unilaterally decide that 25% maintenance isn't enough and they might require 60% starting immediately.
Wow. And that leads to risk six, which I have circled in red because it is a massive exam trap. The customer is not entitled to an extension of time on a margin call.
This is perhaps the most heavily tested concept regarding margin calls.
Really?
Yeah. A broker might send Mary an alert saying, you know, you have margin deficiency. Please deposit funds by Friday at noon. The trap is assuming that the firm is legally obligated to wait until Friday at noon.
Oh, so they can say Friday, but then sell on Thursday.
Yes. They are not obligated to wait. If the market continues to crater on Thursday afternoon, they will liquidate her assets right then and there. A margin call notification is a courtesy. It's not a legal grace period.
Okay, so when you sign that agreement, you really just hand over the keys to the kingdom. Because these powers are so draconian, I imagine the rules around how and when you deliver this disclosure document are pretty strict.
Very strict. For a non-institutional customer like Mary, the initial disclosure must be provided before or at the opening of the margin account.
Okay.
It cannot be buried as paragraph 47 in a, you know, 100-page terms of service packet.
Yeah.
It must be provided in a separate document or contained by itself on a separate page.
It has to physically stand out.
Yes.
And my notes say they also have to deliver it annually. But here's another exam trap. Does annually mean on the anniversary of the account opening?
No. The rule specifies that it must be provided not less than once each calendar year. it does not track the specific account anniversary.
Oh, true.
And unlike the initial delivery, which must be separate, the annual delivery can be combined with other account information.
So like being printed on the back of a December account statement.
Exactly.
So separate page for the initial opening and calendar year for the annual reminder.
You got it.
Okay, let's look at what happens when Mary actually hits one of these deficiencies. We have to separate a Regulation T call from a standard maintenance margin call, right?
Yes, because the timelines for resolution are different.
Okay, so what's the deal with Reg T?
A Regulation T call happens at the very beginning of the trade if she fails to meet that initial 50% requirement. If she creates a Reg T deficiency, the rules state she has one payment period to satisfy it.
And what if she just ghosts the firm? Like, what if she ignores the emails and the payment period just expires?
If the Reg T call is not met in full within the required time, the broker-dealer must liquidate securities sufficient to meet the call or eliminate the deficiency.
Must liquidate.
Must. It is not optional for the firm. They have to sell her out. Furthermore, regulators are very clear that firms cannot allow customers to make a practice of deferring deposits or, you know, meeting Reg T calls by liquidating securities themselves after the fact.
Oh, that's free riding.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That is free riding.
Okay, so Reg T is one payment period followed by mandatory liquidation. What about the other scenario? Like, Mary made her initial deposit fine, but a month later the stock drops and she hits a Finera maintenance call.
Right. So for other margin deficiencies, like dropping below that 25% floor, the rule requires the firm to obtain the required margin as promptly as possible.
Promptly as possible.
And within 15 business days after the deficiency occurred.
So the maintenance timeline is promptly within 15 business days unless Finera grants an extension.
Right.
You know, the through line here is that every single one of these rules, the terrifying disclosures, the strict delivery timelines, the mandatory liquidations, all exist to insulate the broker-dealer from Mary's bad decisions.
Absolutely. The firm's capital is the buffer between Mary and a systemic market failure. Protecting that capital is the paramount objective.
Okay, let's shift gears a bit and look at the actual plumbing of the market. We talked about Mary shorting a stock earlier. We established the math.
Mm-hmm.
But we kind of skipped over the physical mechanics. Like, how do you sell something you don't actually own? Where do those shares come from?
This is my favorite part.
Yeah.
This brings us to the wild west of stock lending.
Yes. It's time to bring our third character into the spotlight, Lending Larry.
Lending Larry is the operational linchpin of the short selling ecosystem. Because the fundamental rule of the market is that you cannot sell what you do not have unless you borrow it first.
Okay, so let's map out the flow of assets. Larry is sitting on millions of shares in his institutional portfolio. Mary wants to borrow them. How does this interaction actually work?
So think of it as a triangular transaction.
A triangle, okay.
The lender, which is Larry, provides the physical stock certificates, or, you know, more accurately today, the digital book entry shares. The borrower, Mary, takes those borrowed shares and immediately delivers them to a third party. Let's call him Steve.
Okay, Steve.
Steve bought them in the open market.
So Steve thinks he just bought normal shares. He has no idea they were borrowed from Larry.
Oh, see, that doesn't know or care. He just wants his stock. But eventually, Mary has a legal obligation to go back into the open market, buy equivalent securities, and return them to Larry.
But Larry is a massive, sophisticated institution. Why would he hand over his valuable shares to a chaotic day trader like Mary?
He wouldn't.
Like, what stops Mary from just taking the shares, selling them, and fleeing the country?
Right. Well, Larry doesn't trust Mary at all. He trusts the collateral.
Mm.
This is where the rental car agency metaphor really comes in. When you rent a car, you leave a hefty deposit on your credit card. During the entire duration of the stock loan, Mary must provide collateral, usually cash, to Larry.
So if Mary defaults and fails to return the shares,
Larry just keeps the cash collateral and uses it to buy the shares back himself.
That makes perfect sense. But let's look at where the firm gets the shares to lend out. What if Lending Larry isn't available?
Oh, this is a massive exam trap.
Yes, regarding whose shares can actually be lent. Let's bring Deficit Dan back into the picture.
Poor Dan.
Poor Dan. Dan has a margin account, but he actually fully paid for $10,000 of Apple stock. He isn't borrowing against it. It's just sitting there. Can the broker dealer quietly take Dan's fully paid Apple stock and lend it to Margin Mary without telling him?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
This is heavily tested. Before a broker dealer can first borrow a customer's fully paid securities or their excess margin securities, the firm must provide written notice to that customer.
So they can't just raid his account in the dead of night to facilitate Mary's short selling.
No. Yeah. Fully paid securities belong to Dan, not the firm. The written notice has to explicitly disclose the risks, the financial impact of the loan-like, you know, how voting rights might change.
Oh, interesting.
And crucially, the member firm's right to liquidate the borrowed transaction. They need documented affirmative permission to lend his property.
Okay, so the firm secures the shares properly. They have the inventory. Now we have to look at what happens on the firm's trading desk right before Mary hits the sell short button.
The locate requirement.
The locate requirement. What is this?
It's foundational to market integrity. Before a broker-dealer can accept a short sale order in an equity security from Mary or effect a short sale for his own account, they must satisfy one of three conditions.
Okay, what are they?
They must actually borrow the security, enter into a bona fide arrangement to borrow the security, or have reasonable grounds to believe that the security can be borrowed so that it can be delivered on the settlement date.
And the firm has to document compliance with this, right? They can't just say, yeah, we totally thought we could find it.
No, documentation is absolutely mandatory.
Let's talk about the why here. What is the disaster scenario this rule is trying to prevent?
It's trying to prevent a failure to deliver. Let's go back to Steve, the guy who bought the shares from Mary.
Okay, yeah.
Settlement day arrives, and Steve's broker is waiting for the shares to hit his account. If Mary hits sell short without actually locating the shares to borrow first, she has sold a ghost. She has created phantom liquidity.
You can't just invent stock out of thin air, take Steve's money, and then shrug and say, oops, I couldn't find any shares to give you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That breaks the fundamental trust of the clearinghouse system.
It totally does.
A failure to deliver creates cascading settlement risks across the entire market. So the locate requirement forces the firm to prove that Larry actually has the shares available and has earmarked them for this trade before Mary is allowed to execute the short sale.
Okay, listener, I want you to take a deep breath. Shake off the stock lending rules because we are moving into the final major concept and it is a complete paradigm shift.
It really is.
We need to talk about day trading and I need you to focus closely here because if you have studied margin rules in the past or if you're using an older textbook, you are going to get tricked.
Seriously tricked.
The rules governing day trading have completely fundamentally changed.
This is honestly one of the most significant regulatory overhauls in recent memory regarding active traders.
I am going to say this as clearly as possible. The old pattern day trader rule is dead.
Dead and gone.
Exam trap. If you see a multiple choice question referencing the old PDT rules, you need to recognize it as outdated trap information.
The entire pattern day trader regime has been scrapped and replaced.
Let's just list the specific concepts that are dead just so we can identify the traps when we see them.
Sure.
Counting 4 day trades in 5 business days.
Dead.
The $25,000 minimum equity requirement for pattern day traders.
Dead.
The special day trading buying power multiplier.
Dead.
The specific day trading margin call?
Also good.
Wow. Okay. So those mechanics, they were built for an older era of the market.
Yeah. And they've been entirely replaced by what is known as the intraday margin standard.
Intraday margin standard. Okay. So if we aren't counting how many times Margin Mary trades in a 5-day period, how do we stop her from blowing up her account in 6 hours? What is this new standard?
Well, instead of looking at trade frequency, the intraday margin standard forces the broker-dealer to measure the actual risk exposure of the account in real time.
Real-time tracking.
Yeah, they are measuring what the day's activity does to the account's margin cushion.
Let's bring Deficit Dan back to explain this because Dan is going to mess this up perfectly.
Oh, Dan.
To understand the new standard, we need to master two concepts. Concept one is the intraday margin level, or IML. How do we define IML?
At any given microsecond, the IML is simply a measurement of the account's margin cushion.
Okay.
It is essentially the amount of cash Dan could withdraw from his account at that exact moment while still meeting all his maintenance margin requirements.
So it's like a thermometer reading.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
If he has extra cushion, his IML is a positive number.
Makes sense.
But if his positions tank and he falls short of his required maintenance margin, the IML becomes a negative number, representing a deficiency.
And the IML just fluctuates constantly as market prices move.
Correct. Constantly.
Which brings us to concept two. The IML reducing transaction.
The trigger.
This is the trigger. So the firm doesn't calculate this constantly for every account. They only calculate it when Dan does something to lower his cushion.
Exactly. Obviously, buying a massive block of stock on margin reduces his cushion. That is an IML reducing transaction.
Right. But listener, here is the massive exam trap. Let's say Dan logs in on Tuesday. He does absolutely no trading, zero buys, zero sells.
Nothing.
But true to his name, he decides to withdraw $5,000 in cash from his account to put a down payment on a jet ski.
Of course he does.
Is that cash withdrawal an IML reducing transaction?
Yes. A withdrawal of cash or securities is definitively an IML reducing transaction.
That trips people up because they think day trading rules only apply to the act of trading.
Right. But taking money out of the account lowers the cushion just as much as a bad trade does.
Yeah.
The firm must determine the IML for each customer margin account for each day in which there is an IML reducing transaction.
Okay, so by withdrawing cash, Dan forced the firm's computers to run the calculation.
Exactly.
So the calculation is triggered. How do we determine if Dan actually violated the rules? How do we calculate the intraday margin deficit? Let's walk through a specific timeline.
Let's do it.
It is 9:30 a.m. The opening bell rings. Dan starts the day great. His portfolio is up. His IML is strongly positive.
Wait for Dan.
But at 12 p.m. noon, he makes a catastrophic options trade, and his IML plummets to negative $10,000. He is severely underwater.
Ouch.
He panics. He spends the next few hours unwinding the bad trades. At 3:59 p.m., right before the closing bell, he wires in cash from his bank, closes the bad positions, and finishes the day at 4 p.m. with a fully margined positive balance. So, listener, if I'm looking at this scenario, and Dan goes negative at lunch but closes the day positive, he's fine, right? He doesn't have a deficit. Pause and think. Okay, what's the answer?
He is not fine. This is the core exam gotcha of the new rule. Dan absolutely have an intraday margin deficit for that day.
But his closing statement shows a positive balance.
It does not matter where he ended the day. The intraday margin deficit is calculated based on the absolute value of the largest negative IML reached during the day.
Oh, wow.
It is a measurement of the absolute worst moment of his risk exposure, regardless of when it happened.
So it tracks the high watermark of your failure. You cannot just hide your mess before the closing bell
Well, you
rings.
can't. The firm's computers caught you dropping to negative 10,000 at noon. Therefore, your official deficit for the day is $10,000.
Brutal. Okay, so what happens to Dan now?
Well, the firm must require that the deficit be satisfied as promptly as possible. Dan basically satisfies it by depositing net cash or by doing something else that permanently increases his IML cushion.
Let's assume Dan ignores it. Does he get thrown into a penalty box immediately for missing one deficit?
No. The restriction criteria are very specific, and this is another area where the exam tests your attention to detail.
Okay.
To get hit with a severe 90-day restriction, two separate things must happen. One missed deficit is not enough.
What are the two criteria?
First, Dan must establish a practice of failing to satisfy these intraday margin deficits promptly.
A practice.
Right? It cannot just be an isolated incident. It must be a pattern of bad behavior. And second, he must fail to satisfy a specific deficit by the close of business on the fifth business day after it occurs.
Okay, so it requires a practice of failing combined with missing the 5-day deadline.
Exactly.
If a test question asks if Dan gets restricted because he missed his very first deficit on the fifth day, the answer is no, because he hadn't established a practice yet. You need both prongs of the rule to trigger the penalty.
Precisely. The regulators are basically looking for chronic risk management failures before dropping the hammer.
Makes sense. Let's say Dan hits both criteria. He's a menace, he establishes a practice, and he blows past the 5-day deadline. He gets thrown into the 90-day penalty box. What does that actually mean? Does the firm freeze his account entirely?
He is not completely frozen out of the market, but his ability to take on risk is eliminated.
Okay.
For 90 calendar days, the firm must prevent Dan from creating or increasing a short position, or creating or increasing a debit balance.
So he can't borrow any more money and he can't short any more stock.
Correct. However, he is still allowed to execute trades that close out existing positions.
Ah.
The restriction focuses entirely on preventing new exposure, not on locking up his existing assets.
The firm is basically saying, Dan, you are a walking liability. We will let you sell what you currently own to get out of the market, but we are not lending you another penny and we aren't letting you short anything else for 3 solid months.
That aligns perfectly with the regulatory intent.
Ah.
The fire department has shut off his access to the matches.
I love that. Okay, my brain is officially full.
It's a lot of material.
We have covered a massive amount of technical plumbing today. It is time for our rapid fire recap.
Let's do it.
If you're attention drifted, listener, come back to me right now. We are going to do a high-energy rundown of the absolute must-know non-negotiable facts from this unit to lock it into your short-term memory before exam day. I will set up the scenario, and I want you to summarize the punchline. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Let's run through them.
Number one, Margin Mary transfers $100,000 of fully paid, marginal Apple stock into a brand new account. Can she borrow against it today?
No. Marginable collateral does not authorize credit. She needs two things. Firm approval of the account, plus a signed margin agreement.
Boom. Number two, what is the fundamental difference between initial margin and maintenance margin?
Initial margin is the down payment required to open the trade, governed generally by Regulation T at 50%. Maintenance margin is the ongoing equity floor required while the trade remains open, governed by FINRA, usually at 25% for long equity.
Got it. Number three, Margin Mary shorts a normal non-exempt equity stock. What is the math behind her total Reg T requirement, and what is her actual required deposit?
The total Reg T margin is 150%. But that is comprised of the 100% short sale proceeds already sitting in her account, plus a required 50% deposit out of her own pocket.
Number four, the terrifying margin disclosure risks. Can the broker-dealer sell Mary's assets without calling her, and does she have the right to demand an extension on a margin call?
The firm can sell without contacting you. The firm chooses exactly what to sell, and you have absolutely no right to an extension of time on a margin call.
Savage. Number five, the locate requirement. Before Mary can short a stock, what must the firm do?
The firm must borrow, arrange to borrow, or have reasonable grounds to believe the stock can be borrowed to prevent a failure to deliver on settlement day. You cannot sell ghost shares.
Number six, the new frontier of day trading. Deficit Dan's account drops to negative $10,000 at lunch, but he deposits cash and closes the day with a positive balance. Does he have a deficit?
Yes. Intraday margin deficits measure the absolute worst point of the day, not the closing balance. And remember, withdrawing cash counts as a trigger.
Yes, it does. Mm. And finally, number seven, how does Dan get thrown in the 90-day penalty box?
He needs two things to happen. He must establish a practice of failing to satisfy deficits, and he must leave a deficit unsatisfied past the close of business on the fifth business day.
Boom. That is the hit list.
Nailed it.
Write those down, memorize them, and look for those exact traps on exam day.
Absolutely. And, you know, before we wrap up, I just want to leave the listener with a broader thought to ponder.
Okay, what's that?
We talked a lot about how the old pattern day trader rules died and were replaced by the intraday margin standard.
Yeah, RIP to the PDT.
Right. But think about why that regulatory evolution actually happened. It reflects a massive structural upgrade in Wall Street's technology.
Oh, because back in the day, the only way regulators could track a day trader was by literally counting the number of trades they made on a calendar. Oh, you traded four times this week. You must be risky.
Exactly. It was a completely blunt instrument based on frequency. But today, regulators no longer care how often you trade. I mean, Mary could execute 50 algorithmic trades a day if she wanted to.
Right.
The regulators don't care about the frequency because the technology now allows them to measure her exact risk exposure, her intraday margin level down to the microsecond.
So the financial fire department isn't just standing around counting how many matches you strike anymore.
No, they aren't.
They are using advanced thermal sensors to measure exactly how hot the flame is getting every single second of the day.
Exactly. And the moment that thermal sensor detects that your flame is getting too hot, the moment your intraday margin drops to an unacceptable negative level, they cut you off.
Wow.
It is a profound shift from behavioral regulation to precise risk measurement.
I love that perspective. It makes the rules feel less like, you know, arbitrary punishments and more like a highly advanced security system.
Right.
Well, I hope this deep dive helped clarify the muddy, murky waters of margin and securities lending. Keep your fireproof suit zipped up, watch out for those exam traps, and best of luck conquering Function 1 on your Series 99 exam. You've got this.